welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we take a look at one of the most curious stories in history, a tale of revenge and honor so fascinating that our guest wrote about it in a book with the intriguing title, The Captain's Concubine, Love, Honor, and Violence in Renaissance Tuscany. In a moment, Talking History's Eileen Dugan will speak with Donald Weinstein. And then Richard Pels will tell us about the Europeans' lack of knowledge of, indeed willful ignorance toward, the history of the United States. But before we get to those subjects, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On June 24, 1948, Soviet forces cut off all land and water routes between West Germany and West Berlin, prompting Western allies to organize the massive Berlin airlift. The confrontation over Germany and Berlin was one of the most menacing struggles of the Cold War. But the country and the city, under terms reached at Yalta, were divided into four zones, each of which was controlled by one of the principal victors in World War II, the United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, and France. The Western Allies soon decided to merge their zones into a Western German state, which included West Berlin, though 100 miles inside East Germany, and they embarked on an economic buildup under the Marshall Plan to make the Western Zone a buffer against the Soviets, who were not included in the plan. Stalin struck back with a blockade of Berlin. The Soviets declared that Berlin was now part of their zone of occupation and refused to allow vehicles to travel through the Soviet zone to the city. The United States responded by flying in millions of tons of provisions to the stricken city. During the winter of 1948-1949, they even funneled coal into the city to warm some 2 million Berliners. Reports of people's sufferings, of pilots' valiant deeds, and of Soviet belligerents helped Westerners to increasingly see the conflict as a moral crusade. By the time the Soviets ended the blockade on May 12, 1949, a divided Berlin had become the symbol of the Cold War. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, two new studies recently published in the journal Science suggested ancient human hunters, armed with fire, spear, and an appetite for meat, drove to extinction most of the large animals in Australia and the Americas. One report found that these specimens, among them elephant-sized marsupials, disappeared within a few thousand years after humans arrived on the Australian continent. The other concluded that the arrival of humans on the American continent some 11,000 years ago initiated the decline of mammoths, camels, saber-toothed tigers, and other large animals. Previous reports blamed climate change, disease, or a gradual change in habitat for the demise of these large creatures. And, hot off the press, Howdy Doody is headed for Detroit. A federal judge settled the dispute of where Howdy ought to be housed by siding with the Detroit Institute of Arts, where he will join the likes of Punch and Judy, Kermit the Frog, and other puppets in the museum's collection. Contesting the decision was Rufus Rose, the puppeteer of Howdy Doody, who took the puppet to his Connecticut home after the show went off the air in 1960. This is Talking History. From the writing of Romeo and Juliet, people have enjoyed reading about the fascinating lives, loves, and social relationships in Renaissance Italy. One story in particular serves as the focal point of a conversation between Eileen Dugan and Donald Weinstein.
To walk through the Italian city of Pistoia is to step back in time. Located some 50 miles from Florence, the city boasts exquisite Renaissance churches and winding old streets. It all looks so charming, so refined. But on one day in 1578, all was not so peaceful in this city, as a street fight resulted in a slashed nose and public controversy. With us today to examine this case of revenge and honor is Dr. Donald Weinstein, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Arizona. Dr. Weinstein is the author of numerous works on Renaissance history, including his recent book, The Captain's Concubine, Love, Honor, and Violence in Renaissance Tuscany. Welcome, Dr. Weinstein.
Thank you.
How did you come across this incredible story?
I was looking for material on dueling and fighting between young aristocrats in the 16th century in Tuscany, an interest which grew out of, strangely enough, an interest in religion and peacemaking and how religion interacts with society. And I used the archives in Pisa of a monastic, well, semi-monastic military order, an order called Santo Stefano, Saint Stephen, because they had jurisdiction over their own members, and therefore they had court records, and these were young men, hot-blooded young men who got into a lot of trouble. And I was going through these cases and came across this one particular case, which was recorded much more extensively and much more graphically and dramatically than most such cases were. And so I started delving into this, and before I knew it, I was hooked on the story.
What was the Holy Thursday incident?
The story, in a nutshell, is that a young nobleman and cavalier of the Order of St. Stephen in the town of Pistoia, his hometown, was walking, as he said, to church one day, Holy Thursday, during Easter week, and was set upon, he says, by five other men, led by a sometime friend of his named Mariotto Celesi, and for no reason whatsoever that he could think of. This led to an investigation, a trial, several trials, in fact, and a host of witnesses who traipsed through the courts of Pistoia and Florence and Pisa, and the story came out, and the story had to do with family honor, the violation of trust on the part of Fabrizio by this family of the Chilesi, and at the heart of the whole matter, a woman, the concubine of the paterfamilias of the Chilesi, who Fabrizio, the man who was attacked, apparently had been paying court to for some months. And that, of course, led to considerable unhappiness on the part of the Chilesi, which was finally expressed by the son of the old man, Mariotto Celesi, attacking Fabrizio in the street.
And what happened to Fabrizio?
Well, not very much, really. He was slashed in the nose and several other places. He brought charges against Mariotto, but he was very quickly exposed as having been engaged in in this hanky-panky with the woman of the father of the Chilesi family, and most of his charges really fell to the ground. He couldn't prove that he had been attacked by five men. He couldn't prove that he had been set upon in an ambush, and he wouldn't talk about the love affair, although it came out through many other witnesses. The whole town practically knew about it. And as a matter of fact, one of the interesting things about it is the way in which the town itself, that is to say, Pistoians and members of some of the better families and just ordinary people as well, really enter into this whole story by becoming a kind of Greek chorus, watching the two men in the street, asking them questions, telling Mariotto that his father's woman was misbehaving, and what was he going to do about it? So that you can see the community exerting its will in this story, as well as the two families involved.
You mentioned that the community sort of becomes a Greek chorus, and you also mentioned in your book that there are overtones of a Renaissance comedy in the whole story. Why is that so?
Well, yes, the story is, a number of people have read the book and said, well, it's just like Shakespeare. And, of course, they're thinking of some of Shakespeare's comedies, which were taken from Italian stories of the 16th and 17th century, the most famous being Romeo and Juliet. You realize that the comedies of the time, not just Shakespeare, but many others, Italian, English, and other countries, are very close to life in many respects. And the line between comedy and reality, between literature and life, begins to get very, very, very indistinct. So that sometimes I found myself wishing that I could rewrite the story and punch up some of the parts that didn't seem terribly dramatic and so on. But of course, as an historian, I couldn't allow myself to do that.
from the story, as a Renaissance historian, you must have noticed certain things about this story that were rather typical for the time. But what did you also find that perhaps was extraordinary that made this more than just a street fight?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I was surprised by the consensus that seemed to exist between ordinary townsfolk of this provincial, rather backwater town, and the aristocrats represented in the Order of St. Stephen, who were the judges of the Mariotto. I was surprised by the general agreement among them as to values, as to what was right and what was wrong, and on the readiness of these aristocratic members of the High Council of the Order of St. Stephen to listen to ordinary townsfolk and to ask their opinion as to what they thought about the behavior of these men. That surprised me a bit, because the 16th century in Italy particularly is supposed to be a time when classes are becoming more rigid, class differences, when aristocratic behavior is an aristocratic membership in the aristocracy is more and more a prized objective of middle class people, and where states are beginning to develop service gentries, in which in other words, where states are being run by a noble class. This appears also in the literature of the time. And yet here was a considerable degree of interaction and of consensus in the society, and I found that very interesting.
Why did this incident even end up in the courts at all? Why wasn't it just left as a street fight?
Well, street fights were disturbances of the peace, and they had to be punished, and particularly... and this is another angle that I was pursuing. In the 16th century, the Medici family succeeds in converting Florence and its territories into an hereditary dukedom, and eventually all of Tuscany, with a few exceptions. And some people have said, some historians have said, that this here you see a model, an early model of the developing absolutist state. With a hereditary monarchy who has all power, enforcing his will upon the people. And, of course, one of the things that he enforced was peace. If there was going to be any violence in the state, it was going to be at the will of the prince to decide what and who was going to be violent. In other words, what Max Weber, the great sociologist, calls a monopoly of violence on the part of the state. So I was interested to see how he would deal with a street fight, which was really a fight over family honor, the honor of the Chilesi being impugned by the misbehavior of this other young man. And he handles it in a way that enforces the state decides when and who can be violent and who can carry weapons and so on, mainly in the form of going to war. And on the other hand, the men who were involved in the breaking of the peace, particularly Mariotto, who attacked Fabrizio, so that you can, in a sense, he's giving the nod in a way to the aristocrats who insist upon defending their own honor in their own way, and at the same time he's acknowledging or forcing other people to acknowledge his jurisdiction as the enforcer of the peace. That's kind of a long-winded, complicated answer. I'm not sure if you follow me, but violence had to be punished in the eyes of the state. Otherwise, you have chaos and anarchy, just as today.
And family honor was also considered very important at that time. Is that true?
Well, indeed. Here you have a nobleman who takes the the sword and wants to enforce the values of honor in his own way, without, in other words, today we might be much more likely to go to law over some sort of violation of our interests. But in those days, aristocrats at least insisted upon taking vengeance in their own hands. So you have a nice tension between the interests of the state in keeping the peace and the interest of private families in defending their own honor.
So far we've been really discussing the men in the story, but what about the mistress, Chiara?
Well, Chiara's an interesting problem. She is the mistress of the concubine of this very wealthy man. She herself is probably a very simple woman who came from the mountains above Pistoia. How she came to come to live with Lanfredino Chilesi, nobody really knows. She apparently left a husband behind in the mountains, and she must have been attracted by all the splendors and material comforts that the old man, a very wealthy man, a very powerful man, could give her. At the same time, she is the creature of, she's the chattel, virtually, of the old man, and when he becomes disappointed with her, believes that she has misbehaved, something was never proven, he just simply kicks her out and cuts her off from the two children they had together, and really very little thought about her. On the other hand, she was a woman who, how should we say, was trying to make her own destiny. However, she decided to leave her husband in the mountains. She did it, and she made her way to Pistoia, where she found a much better life until this involvement.
What do you find her story says about women in Renaissance Italy?
Well, first of all, I have to say that the evidence about Chiara is very limited, and this is one place where an historian, the kind of thing where to know so much, like to know so much more about her, what she thought, what became of her, how she got down to Pistoia in the first place, of this old man. But I don't. So I have very little to go on. On the one hand, it makes me that the story does show, however, the tokens of men, in the sense that not whether or not compromised by his attentions and by paying his attention to some extent, and once she was a liability to the old man because the nation are treated not as men, as their property, their chattel. I find myself speculating a lot about her determination. To remake her life, however immoral we might judge the decision to leave her husband, that's what she did. But one has to try to intuit here a woman of considerable spirit, and that shows itself also in the fact that throughout this long and very difficult process, she was imprisoned, incidentally. Once it came out that she had been involved in this love triangle, she steadfastly protected Fabrizio. She would never admit that he had misbehaved with her in any way. What we do know about Fabrizio's misbehavior all comes from servants who had observed what was going on. So and then she was treated so badly by Fabrizio, the lover who promised her the moon, and by the man that she had lived with and whose children she had borne. She lived with him, incidentally, for 17 years. Another interesting thing about it is that she doesn't fit the ordinary notions we have about Renaissance beauties and the insistence upon youth. She must have been a woman of certainly what they would consider middle age by the time she caught Fabrizio's eye. And I find that interesting as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Weinstein.
You're very welcome.
We have been talking with Dr. Donald Weinstein, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Arizona and author of The Captain's Concubine, Love, Honor, and Violence in Renaissance Tuscany.
Turning to our commentary for the week, is American history on the margins in Europe? Do most Europeans simply ignore the history of the United States? Richard Pell says yes and explains why.
America is the elephant in everyone's living room, but you'd never know it by the way American history is ignored in Europe. If you look at the course offerings at European universities and secondary schools, or at the history shelves in European bookstores, what is striking is the irrelevance of the history of the United States. Cultural impact on Europe. You'd think that America might play a central role in Europe's historical drama. That America barely appears on stage. There are several reasons why Europeans are so incurious about the American past. First, there's the long-held notion that Americans have no history. The United States has always been portrayed in Europe as the symbol of the future, streamlined and up. So our history seems to have nothing to special literature, little interest in, or knowledge of America or its politics. Students are not expected to know the United States, so there's little incentive for teachers to learn the past. Finally, the values sell history are extraneous to the European experience. The Americans is meaningless to their social problems. Yet this doesn't have nothing to learn from American history. The difficulties immigrants faced in the United States and their success in reshaping America's culture, America's politics, can shed light on the most important problem Europeans are now faced with: whether to accommodate the strangers in their own land, and become genuinely multicultural societies. Meanwhile, those Europeans who do study the United States have a comparative perspective that can offset the excessive parochialism of American academics. It would be enormously beneficial if they came to America as visiting professors to teach courses in American history. In the era of globalization, American academics and their fellow citizens need to understand why their country is no longer exempt from the fate of the world. Few people are better equipped to provide that understanding than those abroad who write and teach about the United States.
You've been listening to Richard Pells, Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Not Like Us, How Europeans Have Loved, Hated, and Transformed American Culture Since World War II. This is Talking History. A memory project to tell you about a new collection of papers recently added to the site. Here to Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Library of Congress National Digital Library Program recently announced the final release of the Abraham Lincoln papers on the American Memory website. The 20,000 $61,000 is an annotated transcript of approximately 2 minutes. This follows the release of the Abraham Lincoln story of last year, 15,000 documents. This includes page 50s as well as his and highlights of the emancipation and his August 2064 memo's expectation of the upcoming election. It's relating to these identical contexts, how and why they were written. These transcriptions and annotations and access to papers, teaching, and research value. Find the link in papers on the American Memory Project and Memory Project website of the Library of Congress, libraryofcongress.loc.gov.
And finally, we want to give you some advance notice of two television programs scheduled to air the week of July 4th. On July 2nd, the History Channel will air a new biography, John and Abigail Adams' Love and Liberty. John's passion and eloquence convinced the colonists to fight the British, while Abigail supported John's efforts from the home front. Their life together remains one of America's most enduring love stories. On the big day itself, July 4th, PBS will present Rediscovered on an 8.5-year war against the mighty mightiest military power on earth. Presided over the Constitutional Convention and served as first president of the United States. This program discusses three character traits that allowed him to gain and wield power: skill as a warrior, charisma, and political savvy, and the three that taught him to use it well and then to relinquish it: devotion to right ideas, civility, and magnanimous renunciation. Richard Brookhiser, author of Founding Father, Rediscovering George Washington, hosts the program. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of these History Channel and PBS programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. And until next time, from this iOS FN, this is Brian Lebeau.